Turning now to the book of Daniel, chapter 2 and verse 1. The book of Daniel, chapter 2, verse 1. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. And we're looking at the hand of God in life. So here we have the emperor of the great Babylonian Empire, the king of Babylon, and more recently, conqueror of Egypt and of Judah also, little Judah. Conqueror of many other nations, one who could be described aptly by Daniel as a king of kings, not given to him as a title, but just as a description of his power on earth. In fact, this was the empire that was to be the empire of longest duration in world history. It could be said, without stretching matters, that the Babylonian Empire had been 2,000 years in the making. It had not always had the same power and holdings that it had at the time of Nebuchadnezzar. It built up, but it built up rapidly, and the nations and the peoples from which Babylon and the Chaldeans came had been in the business of empire building before anyone else. It was the first real world empire. There were only four world empires. No other empires have been universal empires such as those we're considering this evening. But here is Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar, invincible in his time, wondering what further fruit there was for him to gain and to take. But here also is Daniel and his three companions and other captives of noble stock who'd been taken from Jerusalem in one of the first raids to take captives by Nebuchadnezzar, even before he was formally king, while he was crown prince. And everything seemed to have come to an end for the young men of Judah. In due time, well, Judah had been conquered, but Jerusalem remained intact as a sort of vassal state of the Babylonian Empire. And it too would be ransacked and would fall quite soon. And it was obvious it was going to happen. And so here's Daniel, already now functioning in his small circle there among the captives as a prophet, receiving the inspired word. But what did the future hold for them? What hope was there for them? The Babylonian Empire, representing the ingenuity of man and the power of man, held total sway. Israel had gone long since. Now Judah would soon be obliterated. Where was the messianic hope? Where were the promises? How were they to be fulfilled? Well, I'm not suggesting for a moment that there was any lack of faith in Daniel and his fellows, but still, they could see no light, even if they firmly believed that God would do something. And at that moment, God begins to reveal himself, and he reveals what is going to take place. And these revelations, well, Daniel chapters 2 to chapter 7, are really all about the building up of human empires and how they strengthen and develop, trusting in man entirely and human acumen and ingenuity. But it will show, the visions will show, that these great states and empires are bound to collapse. They'll soon fall. Now soon, as I mentioned, the Jerusalem will fall, and there'll be mass deportation of the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And the messianic hope will seem certainly to be at a close, but this is the entirely different outcome that God reveals. And it's amazing how it is revealed, because it is initially revealed not to Daniel, the prophet, but to Nebuchadnezzar, the tyrant emperor, the king of Babylon. It is revealed to him. And because it is revealed to him, and that will be known, it is the king's dream, it is what has been imparted to him, well, in due course, it will go viral, as we say today. It will go throughout the empire. This material will be known and will be published. The extraordinary way God works. And yet, it will not boost in any way Nebuchadnezzar, because he is helpless. He receives the vision. He is deeply troubled by it. He's frightened out of his life. This man of total power is overwhelmed by visions which crush him, which make him fearful. He doesn't understand them. And in the end, he's dependent upon a Judean young man, a recent graduate in his courtier's college, who's a mere captive, and he's dependent upon him and his God, the God of Judah and Israel, the one true and living God, to interpret to him the meaning of the visions. So the glory will be God's. It will require a prophet of God to interpret this, but it will come through the king. Well, now just imagine, if everything had been channeled through Daniel, the original vision, the interpretation of the vision, well, you wonder how it would be known. You wonder if Nebuchadnezzar would have detested it and hated it. Of course, it would be a vision that was ultimately against him and his empire and his kingdom. How would that ever have been published? How would information about the ongoing future history of the world and the emergence of the Messiah and his kingdom and his age, how would that ever be known? But at such a time when it looked as though flesh was supreme and that a humanly devised empire was triumphant and the power of man was invincible, God terrifies the emperor and gives this vision of the inevitable collapse of empire after empire and the diminution in stature and duration of each one in turn until the kingdom of Christ comes. It's a very remarkable way for God to unfold that revelation and deliver it to man. And it's right here in this chapter. So first of all, in the first verse of chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. Now I'm sure most of you know this chapter, or the line of it, its presentation, but let's look swiftly through and look for some of the lessons in this during the course of this evening. Verse 2, then the king commanded to call the magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans seems, if we understand the chapter correctly, to be a term that covers all astrologers, sorcerers, all classes of wise man or diviner, so called. Well, the king called them to show him his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And in verse 3, the king confesses that he has dreamed a dream and his spirit was troubled to know the dream. He goes further as the chapter goes on. And that's something for the king to be so overwhelmed that he frankly opens his heart and tells people the terror, the fear that this dream, this vision has given him. And then in verse 4, as you would expect, the Chaldeans speak in Syriac, we're told, in Aramaic, that is, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. Now, verse 5 is a little controversial. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. And that's the phrase which is controversial. The thing is gone from me. Your modern translations will tend to translate it as, the thing is sure, or the thing is firm. And that's probably correct, because the misunderstanding arises from the fact that there, so the experts tell us, there is a Persian word, a sort of loan word in Aramaic, had got into this sentence, and so the translators went different ways on it. But it's most likely that the king refers to his edict, not to the dream, when he says, the thing is gone from me. This, I've made an edict, and this is sure and certain. And here it is. If ye will not make known unto me the dream, with the interpretation thereof, well, there'll be the most severe punishment meted out. And it is really the best reading, that the king knows perfectly well what his dream is, whereas our King James translation would too easily give us the impression, because this has become a famous phrase, that the king had completely forgotten the dream. Well, that's not quite the intention, in all probability, of the original text. The king doesn't say, I've forgotten the dream, you'll need to tell me. But he says, in effect, you'll need to tell me the dream, and this thing is sure. This goes out from me as a decree that if you can't, then you'll be severely dealt with. He knows what he dreamed. That's the most probable explanation of the verse. But even if he doesn't know, and even if the literal reading of the King James Version is correct, which is doubtful, even if he doesn't know the dream, it doesn't really affect the sense and the importance of the passage. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the astrologers, the sorcerers, most probably, this is sure. If ye will not make known unto me the dream, with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses will be made a dunghill or a ruin. He's a despot. He's a tyrant. But equally, those wise men, those astrologers, were immensely arrogant and superior in their bearing. And the king knew them, and he'd become suspicious of them and very cynical about them. And he believed that they would concoct an interpretation among themselves, but really not have any claim to knowledge of what was intended in this dream. Verse 6, if ye dream that show the dream and the interpretation, both ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honour. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. He wants both. The king's reasoning is along these lines. If you can interpret the thing, you should know the original also. Well, they think this is most unreasonable, as we might. Verse 7, they answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and then, in effect, we'll show the interpretation of it. And the king accuses them of buying time. I know of certainty that ye would gain the time. Well, the original says literally, buy the time. This is more modern to our ears, because ye see the thing is gone from me. They are afraid of the edict that has gone from the king. Verse 9, but if ye will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me. So he's very cynical about his astrologers, his wise men. The Chaldeans say to the king in verse 10, and this is really just intriguing to see the way they do it. They say to the king, you're being most unreasonable. But you can't say that to a tyrant. You can't say you're being unreasonable. And the way they say you're being unreasonable is really the mastercraft of words to appease the king. There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. They don't accuse the king directly. They said, nobody's ever asked this before. And it is a rare thing, when they really mean it's never happened. It is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods, who don't live here. So they put it as delicately as they can, that the king is being unreasonable. And it only made the king, verse 12, more furious. And so he issued his edict to destroy that company of astrologers, the Chaldeans, as they're called here, and to get rid of them. Now that decree would have extended to the four Judean young men who'd recently graduated into the court circle, because while they were not astrologers, they had been educated by them. They're evidently considered under the same decree. Verse 13, and the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. Then verse 14, Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard. Reading between the lines, he knows Arioch. Arioch is a prince and a commander and has great responsibility and face-to-face access to the king. He is the one entrusted to carry out the destruction of the house of astrologers. But Daniel seems to know him, and Arioch is ready to listen to him. And I think we can suppose here that it's an indication of the bearing of these four Judean young men. Although they had come out top in the graduating class of captive Jews who were trained as courtiers in the royal court, although he had been given the powers of a prophet by the Lord, had great wisdom and was admired by the king who'd questioned all those young men, nevertheless, he was liked. He wasn't a person whose personality gave offence. He wasn't in the least heady or arrogant in his bearing. I see him as somebody who was courteous and helpful and friendly and humble in his manner. And so you find doors are open to him. And so he's able to approach Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who will give him a hearing, hear him out. And he answered, verse 15, and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty, or so harsh, as some translate it, from the king? Interesting, he doesn't ask him what's this all about, or what has the king done, because that wouldn't be in accordance with the protocol. He asks an indirect question. Why is the king acting in this hasty or harsh manner? And Arioch is then able to give him a full reply. And Daniel went in, verse 16, and desired of the king. The account is written in such a breathless, pacey way that all the necessary protocol is left out. Daniel wouldn't, of course, have been able to walk in and see the king. He would have first had to consult some secretary of state, who would have consulted someone else, and there were probably two or three or more stages, even for a junior courtier, but finally he made it to the king. All that's left out in the excitement of the passage. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. Evidently, because it satisfied the king, he must have indicated that he'd show him the dream as well as the interpretation. I think we have to read that in. And then Daniel didn't know. He didn't have it at this stage. Subsequent verses show us he acted in faith. He reasoned to himself, God has brought me into this place and my companions and trained us and made us acceptable, even though we had to take a stand, even though we insult the king daily. We do not take his fare. We do not eat anything which has been offered to the gods. We have risked giving enormous offense, and yet we've been protected and kept amazingly all this time. God must have a purpose for us. We cannot now be about to be destroyed. It must be that God is going to deliver us in this. And so he goes to the king and offers his services in faith. And verse 17, he went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would pray. Verse 18, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven. That's a beautiful phrase. Don't forget that they were in the court where heaven, well, the sun, the moon, the stars were all gods. And so they hold a prayer meeting to pray to the God of heaven, the true God who's over all those. Those are fictitious, mythological gods. They pray to the God of heaven concerning this secret, what the king has withheld from the astrologers, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Verse 19, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. And this response is helpful to us, instructs us. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, we read it in our scripture reading, what a magnificent prayer from verse 20 there. But you know, it's long been observed that there are seven psalm portions woven into the tapestry of this prayer. Seven portions from the Psalms, five portions from the book of Job, one portion from 1 Corinthians, a phrase from Isaiah, a phrase from the book of Genesis, and a phrase from the book of Exodus. It is a tapestry of scriptures, freely and expertly woven together to make each solid point. So you learn a number of things from this prayer of Daniel's, that he knew the word of God. And he knew it so well that he thought it. And when he prayed, it was all scriptural. Promises and statements and affirmations and prayers. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, the eternity of God. For wisdom and might are his. He knows exactly what he is doing and what needs to be done, and he has the power to do anything that he pleases. And he, verse 21, changeth the times and the seasons, the ages, and he governs and superintends them all. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He determines the length of their reigns and their power, when empires shall be brought to an end, and nation states even. He giveth wisdom unto the wise. He blesses his people with the knowledge of what's going on and the things that will happen. And knowledge to them that know understanding. He reveals things like that only to his people. And then he speaks of Christ. I'm sure that's what verse 22 means. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. Interesting, because the ancient Jewish commentators, who never became Christian, even they interpreted the light there in a messianic way as Christ. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. It may not be a reference to Christ, but of course Christ is the light. and the light dwelleth with him. Verse 3, the prayer proper. I thank thee and praise thee, O God, thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me now what we desired of thee. For thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. And he's forgotten all about his own life, because what is received in this revelation, this night vision, is not only the details of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, but the interpretation of the dream. And he is so overwhelmed by the interpretation and the prediction of the age of Christ and the coming of the future of God after the collapse of the empires, he is so overcome and uplifted by this, he's forgotten. It's been eclipsed that he originally went in prayer to the Lord for their lives, but their lives have paled into insignificance because he's had this great truth. And that's the thing that is true with us. When we're carried away and uplifted by God's plan for the world and for the ages and for the future and these great themes, we forget all about our aches and pains and our problems and needs that perhaps we started to bring to the Lord in prayer. And it's exactly what happens here. No further mention of the safety of Daniel. Now verse 24. Therefore Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. And he did so. As a human touch in verse 25. Arioch, of course, is but a man, and he has no spiritual sensitivities. And he brought in Daniel before the king in haste, going through the various royal secretaries and equerries and so on, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah. Well, the king knew Daniel. He had personally warmly approved him in the questioning, the examining time before his graduation. He'd no doubt observed him since. He'd already had one audience with him. But it's for Arioch an opportunity not to be missed to take the credit, though he doesn't deserve it, for having brought Daniel into the picture. So he does so. And verse 26, the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, that's how he would have addressed him, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen? The king is sticking to his terms and the interpretation thereof. And Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret, the very term that he uses, also confirms that the king knew full well what his dream was. The secret which the king hath demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the musicians and the soothsayers show unto the king? King Daniel doesn't miss the opportunity to remind the king that the Chaldean religionists had no idea what the dream was and would be therefore incompetent to interpret it. But Daniel is not unsympathetic to them, because he seems to put in a word for them as he goes on. Verse 28, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days, the last days. We understand that and we realize that is the age of Christ, the Christian age, the church age. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. But there needs to be an explanation. Daniel's great modesty and determination to give all the glory to God is seen in verse 29. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into my mind, thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter, and he that revealeth secrets, God alone, maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. It's God alone who has given the secret. And here it is, the vision, the image. Verse 31, thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image, an enormous statue. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, it was radiant, curiously, vast and radiant. It's a statue of a human form. We see that as it goes on. Well, yes, it must be, because it represents world empires, human government. It represents the flesh, the power and ingenuity of man. It stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible, terrifying, awesome in the extreme, ferocious and terrifying. Well, those world empires were terrifying. Verse 32, the description begins at the top. The image's head was of fine gold. The most precious part of the statue was the head, of the very purest gold. As you move down the statue, the material is of less value. His breast or chest and his arms of silver. His belly, his abdomen, and his thighs or sides of brass. His legs of iron, immensely strong, but not as valuable as the higher parts. His feet, part of iron and part of clay, very vulnerable. Elements that are tough, strong iron, and elements that are not. So the feet are dangerously weak. Thou sawest, verse 34, till that a stone was cut out without hands. Now the suggestion is that the statue represents and is made by hands. It's the very kind of thing that emperors make to their glory, though nothing like this had ever been seen or heard of. Whereas this stone, this mere stone, obviously represents something divine, because it was cut out without hands. The statue is human power and ingenuity, and government and control and force. The stone is something divine. It comes, a later verse tells us, from a mountain, verse 45, for as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it break in pieces, the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, but we mustn't anticipate that. Back to verse 34, a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and break them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together. So the stone strikes the feet, they disintegrate, and then an extraordinary thing happened in the vision. The disintegration process went on. It passed up from the feet, through the legs, up through the thighs and the abdomen and the chest to the head, through up to the most precious parts, the gold, and everything disintegrated. And it disintegrated so much that it became, middle of verse 35, like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and these millions of bits were carried away by the wind, and no place was found for them. The empires were broken and eradicated entirely, whereas the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. That's the vision. Verse 36, this is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. So the interpretation proceeds. The vision, well, the head represents that present time, the time of Nebuchadnezzar. As you move down the vision, down the statue, you're looking further and further into the future. The feet at the bottom represent the end of the period of time depicted by the statue. And as you go, the materials become less valuable. Each subsequent empire is a lesser entity. And finally, the whole tradition of world empire is broken. There are four empires in the vision. Verse 37, thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar himself. Verse 39, and after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. Well, that would be a shock to Nebuchadnezzar. After him, after the empire that he represented, the 2,000-year-old Babylonian empire, though under other names, but the same people, generally speaking, that great enterprise would be superseded. It would fall. It would be no more. And it would be succeeded by another kingdom, which would also answer to the characteristics of a world empire, but it would be inferior. In fact, the succeeding empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, was geographically greater than the Babylonian Empire. But in other respects, it was inferior. It was never so united. It was much, much shorter, not 2,000 years, 200 years. Duration, in duration, and in unity, it was a much inferior thing. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom. The second was silver, the third is of brass, or rather bronze. Another third kingdom of brass, which was again inferior and shorter still, the empire of the Greeks. Still more extensive, Alexander the Great's conquests, but inferior in so many ways and never united. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. In a geographical sense, even greater still, but inferior, again, in duration, and certainly in unity. The Roman Empire was never united. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. The Roman Empire was the most formidable in many ways. It crushed wherever it went. For as much as iron breaketh in pieces, this is verse 40, and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces, crush and bruise, crush and bruise. A brutal empire in its conquests and in its manner. But it has a fatal flaw. Verse 41, And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest. And then partly of clay, verse 40, partly broken. And verse 43, an intriguing statement, for which there's various interpretations. Whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. The disunity within of the Roman Empire at the beginning of the great experiment to bind peoples together by intermarrying their royal families. And that persisted really until the beginning of the last century. But it doesn't work, says the prophecy, if that's what it refers to. But verse 44, and in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven, this is the stone cut from the mountain, set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Evidently, when the Babylonian Empire was destroyed, though it was utterly destroyed, its culture and some of its buildings even, but many of its ways and its policies lived on in the next empire. So in a sense, when the statue is destroyed, all four empires will be destroyed at once. You say, yes, but the second empire did away with the first. But the first inevitably lived on by passing on its culture, its military methods, its way of thinking. And so the Medo-Persian Empire borrowed a lot from the Babylonians, and the Greek Empire borrowed a lot from its forebears, and the Roman Empire simply perfected all the techniques and methods of the flesh. So although those empires have passed, they're all still one big statue, all gaining from each other, and they're all destroyed at once by the coming of the Messiah and Calvary and the Christian faith and the conquest of the hearts of men, gathering out a people for God's possession, and God bringing all human rules in accordance with his timing and will to an end. But the kingdom of Christ, which we're only just introduced to here, we'll see rich detail as we go on. The kingdom of Christ lives on. So the first vision given to Nebuchadnezzar, interpreted by Daniel, is a tremendous insight into the conflict of the ages. The control and power and rule by human ingenuity and power. The people who put their trust in men and the rule of God. And what an encouragement for Daniel, his companions, and all believers at that time. Our time is up, and the people of God. Everything seems to be against the messianic hope and the promise of Christ. And then this great disclosure, this is only temporary. This vast 2,000-year empire is coming to a close. There'll be another inferior one, geographically greater, but inferior, that will fall all too soon, and another, and then the kingdom of Christ is revealed. It is so amazing that unbelieving, liberal, so-called Christians, scholars, commentators of more recent centuries have said, oh, well, the book of Daniel must have been written after all this happened. Of course, they must explain it that way. The extraordinary accuracy of the prophecies, and we've only skimmed the surface, the content all follows, is so great that for an unbeliever, that's a natural, cynical assumption. But it isn't so. This was what was disclosed. And how it was disclosed, this knowledge went right through the empire. People would be converted by it. People would be made to think. Nebuchadnezzar would never be the same again. Haven't time to read his reaction. We'll go into these great things and far more in the coming weeks, God willing. I'm sorry to take so long on these things, but this is all about this book, the great comparison of the power of man and the power of God. And we'll see more of it. Let's close singing together the hymn 565. Hymn number 565.